This is Audible.
Simon & Schuster presents Tiger Woods by Jeff Benedict and Armin Katayan. Read by Roger Casey. Prologue. Standing between two gravestones, Mike Moeller drove a post-hole digger deep into the dirt, twisting it like a corkscrew. It was Friday, May 5th, 2006, and warm temperatures had softened the earth at Sunset Cemetery in Manhattan, Kansas. Clump by clump, the balding 44-year-old sexton meticulously dug a grave, piling the dirt beside it. In 24 hours, the ashen remains of the city's most famous son would be laid to rest there. Hardly anyone knew the burial was happening, and Moeller aimed to keep it that way. The night before, Moeller had been home watching television when his phone rang. It was about 9 p.m., and the caller didn't identify herself. "We have a burial coming your way," she said. An odd way to begin a call, thought Moeller, especially one made to his home at such a late hour. "What's the name of the deceased?" he asked. "I can't tell you that," the woman said. "Well, I can't help you if you won't give me a name," he told her. "I can't do that unless you sign confidentiality papers," she said. Moeller told her that wouldn't be necessary. The state had required him to sign documents promising confidentiality when he became a sexton 17 years earlier. "I need to know who I'm burying to even know if they have a plot here," he said. She assured Moeller that the deceased had a burial plot. Then Moeller heard a male voice in the background say, "Just tell him who he's burying." "I'm calling on behalf of Tiger Woods," the woman told Moeller. "His father has passed." Lieutenant Colonel Earl Dennison Woods died of a heart attack at his home in Cypress, California, on May 3, 2006. He was 74 years old and had been in failing health, his body weakened by cancer and his longtime affection for alcohol and cigarettes. A Green Beret, who served two tours in Vietnam, Earl achieved worldwide acclaim for his almost mythical role in raising the most famous golfer of all time. He was notorious for making outlandish statements, like the time he predicted in Sports Illustrated that his then 20-year-old son would have more influence on the world than Nelson Mandela, Gandhi, or Buddha. "He is the chosen one," Earl told the magazine. "He will have the power to impact nations." Those were overwhelming expectations, yet Tiger repeatedly said that no one in the world knew him better than his father, the man he frequently referred to as his best friend and hero. Together, they shared one of the most memorable moments in sports history. Immediately after Tiger sank his final putt to win the 1997 Masters by a record of 12 strokes, Earl gave him an iconic bear hug in what was the most watched golf broadcast in U.S. history. An estimated 43 million viewers, almost 15% of all American households, witnessed father and son sobbing in each other's arms as Earl said, "I love you, son." Dozens of golf telecasts had similarly ended with the two of them embracing and Earl whispering those same four words. But Mike Moeller didn't watch golf tournaments. He just wasn't a fan of the game. He'd never even picked up a club. Still, he admired Tiger Woods, and he took great pride in digging the elder Woods' grave. Using a cemetery map, Moeller had located Earl's burial plot, Block 5, Lot 12, Grave 2, right between his parents, Miles and Maud Woods. Since taking over as sexton in 1989, Moeller had dug more than 2,000 graves. Earl's would be a lot smaller than most. He had been cremated. Tiger and his mother, Cultita, were flying from Southern California with a shallow 10-inch by 10-inch square wooden box that contained Earl's ashes. Moeller was ready for them. After nearly an hour of digging, he had fashioned a grave that resembled a miniature elevator shaft. It was 12 inches long by 12 inches wide and 42 inches deep. Using a shovel, he scraped away the loose dirt from the sides, making the edges ruler straight. The next day, at around noon, two limousines pulled up to an old section of the cemetery. Tiger, his wife Elin, and Tiger's mother got out of the first car, and Earl's three children from his first marriage exited the second. Moeller and his wife Kay met them. Near the end of the 20-minute ceremony, Cultita handed Moeller the wooden box containing her husband's ashes. He placed it in the hole and added cement. With the family looking on, Moeller carefully packed the hole with dirt, leveled off the top, and covered it with a piece of sod. The family then filed back into the limousines and, after a brief stop at Earl's childhood home, returned to the airport. Days later, when word got out that Earl Woods had been interred, the local business that produced headstones and gravestones, an outfit called Manhattan Monuments, anticipated an order for a large granite monument. They called Moeller, but he had no information. Neither Tiger nor his mother had left any instructions for a headstone. At first, Moeller thought the family just needed time to figure out what they wanted. Everyone grieves differently, he knew. But 5 and then 10 years passed, and the family still had not ordered a grave marker. "There is no gravestone," Moeller said in 2015. "Not for him. His grave isn't marked at all. The only way to tell where Earl Woods is buried is to know where to look for the corner markers buried in the earth. You have to have a map to find them." In the end, Earl Dennison Woods was buried in the Kansas dirt in an unmarked grave. No stone, no inscription, nothing. "It's like he's not even there," said Moeller. Tiger Woods was the kind of transcendent star that comes around about as often as Halley's Comet. By almost any measure, he's the most talented golfer who ever lived and arguably the greatest individual athlete in modern history. For a 15-year span from August 1994, when he won his first of 3 consecutive U.S. amateur championships as an 18-year-old high school senior, to the early morning hours of November 27, 2009, when he crashed his SUV into a tree and effectively ended the most dominant run in the history of golf, Woods was a human whirlwind of heart-stopping drama and entertainment, responsible for some of the most memorable moments in the history of televised sports. Woods will forever be measured against Jack Nicklaus, who won more major championships. But the Tiger effect can't be measured in statistics. A literary comparison may be more fitting. Given the full spectrum of his awe-inspiring gifts, Woods was nothing less than a modern-day Shakespeare. He was someone no one had ever seen or will ever see again. Woods' golfing legacy borders on the unimaginable. He was both the first golfer with African-American heritage and the youngest golfer in history to win a major championship. He won 14 majors overall on his way to 79 PGA Tour victories, second all-time behind Sam Snead, and more than 100 worldwide. He holds the record for most consecutive cuts made, 142, covering nearly 8 years, and number of weeks ranked number one in the world, 683. In addition, he was honored as Player of the Year a record 11 times, captured the annual scoring title a record 9 times, and won more than $110 million in official prize money, another record. The tournaments he played in shattered attendance marks throughout the world and consistently set viewership records on television. His charismatic presence and 2 decades of dominance, the driving forces in the stratospheric rise in official PGA Tour purses from $67 million in 1996, his first year as pro, to a record $363 million in 2017-18, and the rise of the average tour purse from $1.5 million to $7.4 million during the same period. In the process, he helped make multimillionaires of more than 400 tour pros. Pure and simple, Woods changed the face of golf, athletically, socially, culturally, and financially. At the height of Tiger's career, golf beat the NFL and the NBA in Nielsen ratings. As a spokesman for Nike, American Express, Disney, Gillette, General Motors, Rolex, Accenture, Gatorade, General Mills, and EA Sports, he appeared in television commercials, on billboards, and in magazines and newspapers. He was mobbed by fans wherever he went. France, Thailand, England, Japan, Germany, South Africa, Australia, even Dubai. Kings and presidents courted him. Corporations wooed him. Rock stars and Hollywood actors wanted to be him. Women wanted to sleep with him. For the better part of 2 decades, he was simply the most famous athlete on earth. Tiger wasn't just alone atop the world of golf. In a very literal sense, he was alone, period. Despite his killer instinct on the course, he was an introvert off it, more comfortable playing video games, watching television, or practicing and training in solitude. As far back as childhood, he spent far more time by himself in his bedroom than playing outside with other children. An only child, he learned early on that his parents were the only ones he should truly trust and rely on. They more or less programmed him that way. His father took on the roles of golf mentor, sage, visionary, and best friend. His mother, Kaltita, was Tiger's disciplinarian and fearsome protector. Together, his parents proved an impregnable force that never let anyone trespass on the tightly guarded path to success they had paved for their son. In their Southern California home, where life revolved around Tiger and golf, the mantra was clear: family is everything. The Woods family dynamic made Tiger the most mysterious athlete of his time, an enigma obsessed with privacy who mastered the art of being invisible in plain sight, of saying something while revealing virtually nothing. On one hand, he grew up before our eyes, appearing on television shows as early as age 2 and being photographed and chronicled throughout his childhood. On the other hand, so much of his true family history and personal life remained shrouded in conditional interviews, carefully constructed press releases, mythical tales, half-truths, sophisticated advertising campaigns, and tabloid headlines. So we were not surprised when Woods, through his chief spokesman, Glenn Greenspan, declined to be interviewed for this book, or to be more precise, we were told that before any interview would be considered, we needed to disclose whom we spoke to, what they said, and the specific questions we would be asking, conditions that we were not willing to meet. Woods' mother, Cultita, in turn, did not respond to our request for an interview. Woods did, however, authorize his longtime chiropractor to provide a comprehensive statement about his treatment of Woods and the issue of performance-enhancing drugs. In an effort to be comprehensive, we began by reading every book of significance about Woods, more than 20 in all, authored by him, his father, former coaches, a former caddy, Earl's first wife, Barbara Woods Gary, and more. Included on that list were the often outstanding efforts of journalists such as Tom Callahan, John Feinstein, Steve Helling, Robert Lustich, Tim Rosefort, Howard Soons, and John Strege. We would be remiss if we failed to single out two invaluable sources of information. The 1997 Masters, My Story, by Tiger Woods with Lauren Rubenstein, published in 2017 on the 20th anniversary of Woods' historic win at Augusta, and The Big Miss, My Years Coaching Tiger Woods by Hank Haney. We mined virtually every page of both books for insight, facts, and reflections that kept our narrative true and on track. In addition, we read books on Buddhism, Navy SEALs, gifted children, success, the business of golf, sex addiction, compulsive behavior, infidelity, and performance-enhancing drugs. Simultaneously, we spent months constructing a comprehensive 120-page timeline of Woods' life, detailing every significant moment or event dating back to the birth of his parents. We also reviewed the transcripts of more than 320 official press conferences at which Tiger spoke between 1996 and 2017, as well as dozens of transcripts of interviews he granted on a wide range of topics with news organizations and television programs. With the help of a researcher at Sports Illustrated, we compiled and read thousands of newspaper, magazine, and journal articles about Tiger. And with assistance from CBS, NBC, Golf Channel, and the PGA, we looked at more than 100 hours of footage of Tiger on and off the course. Over a 3-year period, we also conducted more than 400 interviews with over 250 people from every walk of Woods' life, from teaching professionals and swing coaches who once occupied a place in his inner circle, to close friends on and off the tour, to his first true love. But some of our greatest insights came from the scores of people in Tiger's past who have never been interviewed previously, those who helped finance his amateur career, the owner of the Augusta home where Tiger stayed during the Masters year after year, a close female confidant, former employees, business partners, his scuba diving instructor, his neighbors in Isleworth, and those who worked with him behind the scenes at IMG, Nike, Titleist, EA Sports, NBC Sports, and CBS Sports. Early on, we discovered that two of the qualities Woods values most are privacy and loyalty. As to the former, many of the individuals we approached, from Tiger's former agent, J. Hughes Norton III, to past employees of Tiger's ETW Corp, had signed non-disclosure agreements that prohibited them from speaking to us. I was, as most others in his circle were, sworn to contracts and other legal documents, one former employee told us in an email. It's not unusual for public figures to require those around them, especially those with access to family members and personal information, to sign confidentiality agreements. But Tiger took extraordinary steps to protect even the most mundane information about his past. For example, he personally requested that his high school yearbooks not be shared with anyone. Remarkably, the public school district granted his wish, telling us we were not allowed to look at them. We ended up viewing his yearbooks at the local library instead. As for loyalty, Individual after individual told us they would have to check with Tiger before agreeing to speak. One former high school classmate of his, whom we approached in hopes of simply learning about Anaheim's Western High School, said he would first need permission from Tiger. We told him not to bother. All of this begs the question, why tackle this project in the first place? Our answer is simple. Very few individuals are known throughout the world by one word. Tiger reached that exclusive club by being the greatest golfer, some would argue the greatest athlete in modern history. But his story transcends golf, and his influence reached around the globe. Yet there has never been a comprehensive biography that offers a 360-degree look at Tiger's entire life to date, one that closely examines his roots and the vital role his parents played in the epic rise, fall, and return. After writing The System, a deep dive into the complex world of big-time college football, we were searching for another mountain to climb. We could think of none more imposing or exhilarating than Mount Woods. Our objective from the beginning was to deliver something fresh and revealing, and in the process, construct a complete human portrait of a true, albeit reluctant, American idol. This book is that portrait. Chapter 1. The End. Barefoot and groggy, the most powerful athlete on the planet hid behind a locked bathroom door. For years, like an escape artist, he had been able to cover the tracks of his secret life. Not this time. His wife was finally on to him. But there was so much more she didn't know, so much more that no one knew. It was around 2 a.m. on Friday, November 27, 2009, the day after Thanksgiving. His mind likely clouded by prescription drugs, the man so obsessed with privacy couldn't have foreseen that his next move would shatter his picture-perfect image and lead to the steepest fall from grace in the history of modern sport. Tiger Woods opened the door and fled. 2 days earlier, the National Enquirer, hot on his trail for months, had published a bombshell story, Tiger Woods' cheating scandal, with pictures of a stunning 34-year-old New York nightclub hostess by the name of Rachel Uchitel. The supermarket tabloid accused Tiger of orchestrating a racy rendezvous with Uchitel a week earlier in Melbourne during the Australian Masters. Insisting it was just another lie, Woods had taken the extraordinary step of putting Uchitel on the phone with his wife, but after 30 excruciating minutes, Elin still wasn't buying her husband's story. She might have been blonde and beautiful, but she wasn't stupid, and after Tiger returned to the house Thanksgiving evening after playing cards with some of the boys down at the club in their gated Isleworth community outside Orlando, Elin waited until he had taken an Ambien and drifted off to sleep. It was well after midnight when she took Tiger's phone and started scrolling. A single text from Tiger to a mysterious recipient cut her heart in two. "You are the only one I've ever loved." Elin stared at those words, then used Tiger's phone to send a text of her own to the unknown person. "I miss you," Elin typed. "When are we seeing each other again?" Within seconds, a return text appeared, expressing surprise that Tiger was still awake. Elin dialed the number. A woman answered in the same smoky voice that she had heard professing innocence the day before. "Uchitel!" "I knew it," Elin shouted. "I knew it!" "Oh, fuck," Uchitel said. Moments later, Elin's shouting roused Woods from his slumber. Stumbling half-dazed out of bed, he took his phone and retreated to the bathroom. "She knows," he texted Uchitel. But in truth, Woods didn't fear the woman standing on the other side of the bathroom door. He'd been cheating on her for years with dozens of women, feeding an insatiable appetite for sex that had spiraled into an out-of-control addiction. No. The only woman he had ever truly feared was the one sleeping in a guest room in another part of the mansion, his mother, who was visiting for the holiday. Now a widow for more than 3 years, Cotita Woods had endured what was at times a humiliating marriage that included verbal abuse, neglect, and adultery. Tiger worshipped his father, but he hated how he'd broken his mother's heart. For Tiger's sake, Cotita never divorced Earl, choosing instead to preserve the family name and dedicate her life to raising her only child to be a champion. Reputation and Tiger, nothing mattered more than those two things to Cotita. When Tiger was young, his mother had laid down the law. "You will never, ever ruin my reputation as a parent," she told him, "because I will beat you." When he was a boy, the fear of her hand helped keep Tiger in line. Now that he was a man, There was nothing more terrifying than the prospect of his mother learning that he had followed in his father's footsteps. Looking her in the eye would be brutal. Wearing nothing but shorts and a t-shirt, Woods emerged from the golf house into the 40-degree air. Elon reportedly gave chase with a golf club in hand. In an attempt to get away, Tiger hustled into his Cadillac Escalade and sped out of the driveway, immediately crossing over a concrete curb and onto a grass median. Swerving hard to his left, he crossed Deacon Circle, jumped a curb, grazed a row of hedges, swerved back across the road, and collided with a fire hydrant before plowing into a tree in his next-door neighbor's yard. Swinging the club, Elon shattered the rear driver's side and rear passenger's side windows. Kimberly Harris woke to the knocking sound of a sputtering engine. Looking out the window, she saw a black SUV at the bottom of her driveway. The front end was crumpled against a tree, and the lone remaining headlight was shining at the house. Worried, she woke her 27-year-old brother, Jarius Adams. "I don't know who's outside," she told him, "but I think you need to go out there and find out what's happening." Adams walked cautiously out the front door, trying to process what he was seeing. Woods was lying flat on his back on the pavement. He was shoeless, unconscious, and bleeding from the mouth. There was broken glass on the driveway and a bent golf club beside the vehicle. Sniffling, Elon hovered over her husband. "Tiger," she whispered, gently shaking his shoulders. "Tiger, are you okay?" Crouching down, Adams observed that Tiger was asleep, snoring. His lip was cut. His teeth were bloodstained. "Please help me," Elon said. "I don't have a phone with me. Will you call someone?" Adams ran back inside and yelled to his sister to get blankets and pillows. "Tiger is down," he told her. Then he ran back outside and called 911. Dispatcher. 911, what's your emergency? Adams. "I need an ambulance immediately. I have someone down in front of my house." Dispatcher. "Sir, is it a car accident?" Adams. "Yes." Dispatcher. "Now, are they trapped inside of the vehicle?" Adams. "No, they're lying on the ground now." Dispatcher. "Medical is on the line, sir, okay?" Adams. "I have a neighbor. He hit the tree, and we came out here just to see what was going on. I see him, and he's laying down." Dispatcher. "Are you able to tell if he's breathing?" Adams. "No, I can't tell right now." Suddenly, Cultita Woods emerged from Tiger's house and ran toward the scene. "What happened?" she yelled. "We're trying to figure that out," Adams told her. "I'm on the phone with the police right now." Tears in her eyes, Cultita turned to Elon. Soon they heard a siren and saw blue lights approaching. A Windermere Police Department cruiser pulled up, followed by an ambulance, a sheriff, and a Florida highway patrolman. Paramedics checked Tiger's vital signs and started testing for paralysis, attempting to generate movement by stimulating his left foot. Groaning, Tiger opened his eyes, only for his pupils to roll back in his head while his eyelids remained open. All that was visible were the whites of his eyes. As the paramedics hoisted Tiger's gurney into the ambulance and sped off, Cultita's question lingered in the air. What happened? Why had Tiger Woods fled his home in the middle of the night? And how did the most celebrated athlete of our time end up looking lifeless on the side of the road? Within days, the world would be asking far more troubling questions. The answers, much like the man, proved to be complicated. And when retracing a twisted journey, the best place to start is the beginning. Chapter 2, Family Matters. On September 14, 1981, 5-year-old Tiger Woods entered a kindergarten classroom at Cerritos Elementary School that had been carefully decorated to help put children at ease. It was the first day of school. Pictures of animals and nature were tacked to a couple of bulletin boards. Hand-colored drawings, one of fluffy white clouds against a blue sky, and another of a bright yellow sun with beams radiating from it, were taped to a side wall. Numbers and the letters of the alphabet ran along the top of the chalkboard, but none of it diminished the fact that Tiger felt different from all the other kids, vastly different. Instead of toys, his prized possession was a custom-made set of golf clubs. Besides his parents, his closest friend was his golf instructor, a 32-year-old man with a mustache named Rudy. Tiger had already appeared on national television a couple of times, performed in front of millions of people, and rubbed shoulders with Bob Hope, Jimmy Stewart, and Fran Tarkenton. His golf swing was so smooth that Tiger looked like a pro in a miniature body. He had even signed autographs, printing Tiger in block letters to compensate for the fact that he had yet to learn cursive. He was a whiz with numbers, too. When he was 2 years old, his mother taught him how to add and subtract. He was three when his mother created a multiplication table for him. He worked on it every day, over and over. The more she drilled him, the more he developed a love of numbers. In math, he was performing at a third grade level, yet no one in his kindergarten class knew any of this, not even his teacher. Tiger quietly found a chair among nearly 30 other kindergartners. Only three things were discernible about him. His skin was a little darker than everyone else's, he was painfully shy, and he had a very peculiar first name, Eldrick. But when kindergarten teacher Maureen Decker played a song written to help the children introduce themselves that first day, he referred to himself as Tiger. Throughout the remainder of the class, he resisted Decker's gentle attempts to get him to talk. It wasn't until class was over that he gingerly approached his teacher and tugged at her. "Don't call me Eldrick," he stammered. "Call me Tiger." Caltita Woods gave the same instructions. Address her son by his nickname, not his given name. Tiger lived 1/10 of a mile from the school. Each morning his mother dropped him off and each afternoon she picked him up. Then she would drive him to a nearby golf course where he practiced. It didn't take long for Decker to recognize that Tiger had an unusually structured routine that left little to no time for interacting with other children outside of school. Academically, he was way ahead of the other kids in his class, especially when it came to anything related to numbers. He was also unusually disciplined for a 5-year-old, but he seldom spoke, and he looked lost on the playground, as if he were gun-shy when it came to playing with others. As an adult, Tiger reflected back on his childhood and the fact that he focused solely on golf. In a 2004 authorized DVD collection, Tiger said that he liked to run and play baseball and basketball as a kid, but he didn't love it. "Golf was my decision," he said. But his elementary school teachers have a different recollection. At the first parent-teacher conference, Decker diplomatically raised her concerns and suggested involving Tiger in some after-school activities. Earl instantly dismissed the idea, making it clear that Tiger played golf after school. When Decker tried explaining the benefits of letting Tiger make friends with kids his own age, Earl cut her off. He knew what was best for his son. Caltita remained quiet, and the conference ended awkwardly. Decker decided she wouldn't bring it up again, but one day Tiger approached her during recess. "Ask my mom if I can go play soccer," he said softly. Decker talked to Caltita privately. The two of them had developed a friendly rapport, and Caltita agreed with Decker that it would be good for Tiger to play soccer with the other children. She pleaded with Tiger's teacher to continue encouraging Earl to allow Tiger to participate in after-school activities. So, at the next parent-teacher conference, Decker raised the subject again. This time, Earl got animated. While he pontificated about knowing what was best for his son, Caltita again kept silent. The bottom line? No soccer. It was golf and nothing else. "I felt sorry for the child, because he wanted to interact with others," Decker said. At a time when very few fathers attended parent-teacher conferences at Cerritos Elementary, Earl Woods was known for always showing up. Sometimes he even arrived without Caltita. School administrators got used to seeing more of him than they did of any other father. He even came for show and tell. Ann Berger, Tiger's first grade teacher, said she would never forget that day because it was the most unusual show and tell in her 30-year teaching career. Earl walked in with a bag of miniature golf clubs, and Berger ended up taking her entire class outside where Tiger put on a show, blasting golf balls all over the playground. "He was good," Berger recalled. "He had special clubs. They were little clubs, but they were his clubs." Tiger was the show, and Earl did the telling, explaining to the children how his son had become so accomplished through hard work and practice. The 6-year-olds were in awe, but the performance was just one of a series of observations that raised questions in the minds of some of Tiger's teachers. What is this child going through? What goes on in his home? What is the family dynamic? Part of Tiger Woods' family tree is rooted in Manhattan, Kansas, a hard-scrabble, wind-blown city that was segregated when Earl Woods was born there on March 5th, 1932. His father, Miles Woods, a 58-year-old stonemason whose health was already in decline at the time of Earl's birth, was affectionately described by his children as an old fussy-cussy man. A faithful Baptist who avoided alcohol and cigarettes, Miles nonetheless had a legendary habit of using foul language. "My father taught me discipline and how to swear," Earl would later say. He could swear for 30 minutes and never repeat himself. Earl's mother, Maud, a mixed-race woman of African, European, Chinese, and Native American ancestry, had earned a college degree in home economics from Kansas State University. She taught Earl to read and write in a cramped 1,300-square-foot home. The family had no car and no television, and Earl spent a lot of time outdoors with his father. Together, they built a stone wall between the family home and the street. "He showed me how to mix the mortar," Earl said. "He had his own way. He'd say, 'You've got to have the right amount of spit in it.' He'd spit in the bucket and say, 'Yeah, that's about right.'" Earl also spent a lot of time with his father at Griffith Park, a new minor league baseball stadium in town where Miles was a scorekeeper. Miles could recite the names, batting averages, and pitching statistics of every future major leaguer who came through Manhattan. He scored his final game in August 1943, hours after the final pitch. Miles died from a stroke at age 70. Earl was 11 at the time and recalled watching his grieving mother sit in a rocking chair, repeatedly humming the words from the gospel hymn, "What Are They Doing in Heaven?" 4 years later, Maud also suffered a stroke and died. Earl, just a few months shy of turning 16, was suddenly an orphan who ended up in the care of an older sister who ran the house like a little dictator. Earl's father had one obsession when he died. He wanted Earl to become a professional baseball player. Nothing would have made him prouder. Knowing this, Earl set his heart on joining the big leagues. It was a dream that got a boost in 1947 when Jackie Robinson broke the color barrier and joined the Brooklyn Dodgers. That summer, Earl was working as a bat boy at Griffith Park, and many of the best players in the Negro Leagues were barnstorming across the Midwest. Earl met Roy Campanella, Josh Gibson, and Monty Irvin. He also said that one afternoon during batting practice, he caught for legendary pitcher Satchel Paige, whose fastball was believed to hit 100 miles an hour. After graduating from high school in 1949, Earl enrolled at Kansas State and joined the baseball team as a catcher. He would also pitch and play first base. By his junior year, he was one of the best players on a very bad team. As an adult, Earl published a best-selling memoir in which he claimed to have earned a baseball scholarship and broken the color line as the first black athlete in the Big 7, later the Big 8 and now the Big 12, conference. Both statements were exaggerated. "He didn't get a scholarship from me," former Kansas State baseball coach Ray Wathier told journalist Howard Soons in 2003. "I think he put that in the story to make it sound a little better." Nor was Earl the first black athlete to play in the Big 7. Harold Robinson and Verrill Switzer, who later played for the Green Bay Packers, preceded him. But Woods was the first black player to make the American Legion All-State team in Kansas, which prompted Wathier to offer him a spot on the K-State roster, earning Earl the distinction of breaking the Big 7 color line in baseball. Woods' baseball career would never advance beyond college, but his views on race were strongly influenced by his experience as the only black player on the roster. Once, while the team was on a spring training trip to Mississippi, an opposing coach saw Woods warming up and told Coach Wathier that his catcher would have to remain on the bus and not play. Wathier responded by telling all his players to get back on the bus. The team left without participating. On another occasion in Oklahoma, a motel manager informed Wathier that his lone black player would not be allowed to stay, suggesting instead that Woods spend the night at a different motel 3 miles away. Wathier canceled the reservation for his entire team. These experiences were hardly Earl's first encounters with racism. Back at Manhattan High School, he had his eye on an attractive white girl. He had always wanted to dance with her, but he didn't dare ask. In Kansas, in the late 40s, a relationship with a white girl was out of the question. Instead, he kept to himself, storing in his mind an inventory of taunts, snubs, and personal roadblocks that came his way because of the color of his skin. During his junior year of college, Earl joined the ROTC. The first time he put on a military uniform, he felt an unfamiliar sense of pride and self-worth. Unfamiliar because he'd never quite gotten over the fact that he wasn't talented enough to make it as a pro ball player the way his father had wanted. One year after graduating from K-State with a degree in sociology, Earl enlisted in the Army and got engaged to Barbara Ann Hart, a local girl he'd known since they were kids. She had moved to San Francisco to attend college, but at Earl's urging, she dropped out in her second year and moved back to Kansas. On March 18, 1954, they were married at the courthouse in Abilene during a thunderstorm. She was 20, and he was 22. The storm was an omen of things to come. Barbara Hart believed that Earl Woods was a man who was going places. He owned a 1936 Chevy he called Jitney. He listened to jazz. He had a college degree. And his first serious military assignment was in Germany, where he quickly advanced to platoon leader. Their first child, Earl Woods Jr., was born at an army hospital near the small village of Zweibrücken. It all seemed so romantic. Over the next few years, Earl and Barbara had two more children, Kevin Woods, born June 1, 1957 in Abilene, Kansas, and Royce Woods, born June 6, 1958 in New York. By the time Royce came along, Earl was stationed at Army headquarters in Fort Hamilton, Brooklyn, and the family was living nearby. That's when Earl started to disappear. With three children under the age of four, he enrolled in a master's degree program at New York University. His days were spent on the base and his nights were spent at school. When he wasn't working or studying, he stayed out with his army buddies, all of whom called him by his nickname, Woody. His marriage had already begun to disintegrate when he received orders to go to Vietnam in 1962. Barbara packed up the children, ages 7, 5, and 4 at that point, and moved to San Jose, California, settling into a tiny three-bedroom home. With Earl in Vietnam, Barbara's resentment toward him festered. She felt abandoned, and when Earl returned from a year overseas, he felt like a stranger in his own home. He described arriving at the house in California late at night and finding the door locked. He knocked loudly enough to wake Barbara. "Who's there?" she said from behind the door. "It's me," he said. Long pause. "Who is me?" she said. "Open the damn door," he yelled. Moments later, their little girl stumbled out of bed and entered the room. "Mommy," she said. "Who is that man?" Earl later acknowledged that his children suffered from his long absences. In his memoir, he wrote, "I admit that I am to blame for that." Yet his military career was advancing at an impressive rate. Upon returning from his first of two tours in Vietnam, he was assigned to the Army's John F. Kennedy Special Warfare Center and School, and then to the 6th Special Forces Group at Fort Bragg in North Carolina. He went from there to Ranger School to Airborne School. At 32, against all odds, he became a Green Beret and went off to the Alaska wilderness for advanced survival training exercises. Then one day in the summer of 1966, he went home and informed Barbara that he had received orders to go to Thailand. She instantly became excited about the prospect of taking the family overseas, but Earl informed her that his orders were for an unaccompanied tour, meaning his wife and children had to stay behind. In the spring of 1967, Lieutenant Colonel Earl Woods showed up at a U.S. Army office in Bangkok, where he planned to conduct job interviews with civilians who were applying for jobs on a local Army project that he was overseeing. With an assistant at his side, Woods approached the reception desk. A young Thai woman looked up and said in English, "May I help you, sir?" She addressed the question to Woods' assistant, a white man who she assumed was in charge. Woods didn't bother correcting her as she escorted him and his assistant to a private office that was separated from the reception area by a large glass window. Earl took a seat, put his feet up on the desk, and started issuing orders. Through the glass, he noticed that the secretary had returned to her desk and was looking at him. "I was drawn to her immediately," he later wrote. "She was a stunningly attractive woman." Woods turned to his assistant and said, "I'm going to go and talk to this fine little thing." In his memoir, Woods described what happened next. I was so drawn to the striking woman with the expressive eyes. I approached her, and boy did she blush. She had figured out by then that I was the colonel, not the assistant. As she started to apologize, I said, "No, no, don't worry about that." That seemed to make it easier for us to talk on a more personal level. We chatted, made small talk, and she laughed easily. Her face was aglow and her eyes sparkled. I immediately felt a bond with her. Walking away, I was smiling like hell. I had me a date. Kotita Pansawad was born in 1944 outside of Bangkok, the youngest of four children in a well-to-do family. Her father was an architect, her mother a teacher. Kotita, known as Tida, pronounced T-da, was five when her parents divorced. If that wasn't jarring enough, she was placed in a boarding school until she was 10. "After they divorced, it was hard for me," she said in 2013. "When I was put in the boarding school, for 5 years I almost never went back to any of my family, just stayed at the school. Every weekend I'd hope my father or mother would visit me, or my older brothers or sisters, but no one ever came. I felt abandoned." As an adult, Tita confided to a friend that her childhood was traumatic and lonely. Well-educated and conversant in English, she took a job in her early 20s as a civilian secretary and receptionist at a U.S. Army office in Bangkok. When Lieutenant Colonel Earl Woods showed up there in 1967, she had no idea that he was married with children. She simply liked the fact that he paid attention to her. Their entire first date, which took place on a religious holiday, was spent in church. It was a humble beginning to a relationship that would ultimately result in her giving birth to one of the greatest athletes in history. But at that moment in Bangkok, the prospects that anything would develop from her encounter with a U.S. serviceman likely seemed remote. They lived 8,000 miles apart. She was 12 years younger than he was and had never left her homeland. He was an experienced world traveler with a family of his own. Plus, they were so different. She was a practicing Buddhist. He was a lapsed Baptist. Nevertheless, talk of Kaltita's joining Earl in America happened fast, but not without a warning about racism. "I know you are from Thailand," Earl told her. "I know you're a Thai. But in the United States, there are only two colors, white and non-white. Whites will let you know without a doubt that you are non-white. You'll see it in their actions and reactions to you. So don't think you can ever be a full-fledged citizen here in the United States." When his tour in Thailand ended, Woods was assigned to Fort Totten near Bayside, Queens, New York. Barbara and the children joined him there. He soon took a part-time position at City College of New York as an assistant professor of military science, teaching ROTC students psychological warfare studies. Barbara felt as though he were using his psychological warfare training on her. She recounted the following exchange as an example of his verbal and emotional manipulation. Barbara: "I don't understand. What did I do wrong?" Earl: "You don't know?" Barbara: "I don't know what you're talking about." Earl: "Girl, you're losing it. You need help." After enough of these kinds of exchanges, Barbara started to question whether she was, in fact, losing it. Once a confident, self-assured woman, she telephoned her sister in tears, telling her, "I know I'm not crazy," but Earl's mind games were having an effect. "Maybe Earl is right," she told her sister. "Maybe I do need help." A short time later, on May 29, 1968, Earl came home with his friend Lawrence Krutek, an up-and-coming New York attorney. Barbara was in the bedroom watching television when Earl asked her to join them in the living room. Barbara noticed that Krutek was carrying a briefcase. "This is undoubtedly the hardest thing I've ever had to do," Krutek told her. He opened his briefcase, pulled out a legal document, and started reading the first paragraph. "Whereas the parties hereto are now husband and wife, having been married on the 18th day of March, 1954, at Abilene, Kansas." "Wait a minute," she interrupted. "What is this?" "Woody wants a legal separation," Krutek said. Blindsided, she turned to Earl, who was sitting in the corner of the room. "Yes," Earl said, not uttering another word. Krutek handed Barbara the document and encouraged her to read it. She could hardly focus, but she read, Whereas by reason of certain unfortunate differences that have arisen between the parties hereto as the result of which they are desirous of living separate and apart. She couldn't get past separate and apart. What did that even mean? What was happening? The agreement stipulated that Earl and Barbara Woods would live apart for the rest of their lives as if sole and unmarried. Barbara would have custody of the children, and Earl would have the right to visit them. He would also pay her $200 per month for her support and for the support and maintenance of the said children. Reeling, Barbara signed the document without consulting a lawyer. That summer, Earl and Barbara drove with the children from New York to their little home in San Jose. They turned the road trip into a rare family vacation, stopping at landmarks such as the Liberty Bell and the Lincoln Memorial along the way. They spent a night in Las Vegas. Earl and Barbara even made love. It felt like a second honeymoon, prompting Barbara to wonder out loud, "Why do we have to separate?" "Because we have to," Earl told her. As soon as the family was settled in California, Earl flew back to New York. He was gone for months. The next time he visited San Jose, Barbara's uncle picked him up at the airport and was surprised to see Earl exit the plane with an Asian woman. Earl told Barbara's uncle that he had just met her on the flight and that he was going to help her find a job back in New York. At this point, it had been approximately a year and a half since Earl had first dated Cultita. After her arrival in the United States in 1968 at age 25, she eventually landed a job at a bank in Brooklyn, and according to Earl, they were married in New York in 1969. But Barbara Woods knew nothing about her, and Barbara's uncle didn't have the heart to tell her that another woman had entered the picture. In the spring of 1969, Barbara's health took a bad turn. She suffered severe hemorrhaging, and doctors discovered fibroid tumors. Scheduled to undergo a hysterectomy, Barbara pleaded with Earl to come to San Jose. He came, but on his way he made a detour to Mexico, and he didn't reach California until 4 days after the surgery. That night, while Barbara was recuperating in bed at home, Earl informed her that he had obtained a divorce in Juarez, alleging the incompatibility of temperaments between the spouses. Barbara was speechless. She would later write in her memoir that she and Earl woke the children, told them that their parents were no longer married, and then tried unsuccessfully to get them to stop crying. Earl then walked out on Barbara for good. It turned out that Earl had not actually secured the divorce he sought. On August 25, 1969, 2 days after Earl returned from Mexico, the U.S. consulate declined to validate the paperwork, stating, "The consulate assumes no responsibility for the contents of the annexed document, nor the validity of the document or for its acceptability in any state in the United States." At this point, Barbara was unaware of the consulate's opinion and of anything that had transpired between her husband and Cultita. All Barbara knew was that she had had enough. On August 25, 1969, the same day the U.S. consulate had declared Earl Juarez's divorce invalid, she began divorce proceedings in San Jose, citing extreme cruelty and grievous mental suffering. More than 2 years later, on February 28, 1972, the Superior Court of California determined that the parties are still married and neither party may remarry until a final judgment of dissolution is entered. The court later issued that judgment, officially recognizing the divorce of Earl and Barbara Woods on March 2, 1972. But by that time, Earl and Cultita had been married for almost 3 years, and Barbara had a better handle on what had been going on behind her back. "I question the legality of that marriage," Barbara Woods said in a subsequent court filing. "This man was a bigamist, according to California laws. All this was a cold, calculated plan. There has been fraud perpetrated from the very beginning." In response to those charges, Earl filed a sworn declaration. In it, he stated, "We obtained a divorce in Mexico sometime in 1967. I remarried in 1969. This was not true. A certified copy of the judgment of divorce in Mexico shows that Earl Woods sought a divorce there on August 23, 1969. 2 years after he claimed he had done so. Plus, the state of California subsequently ruled that he had remained legally married to Barbara Woods until 1972. But Earl wasn't concerned. "I don't know anything about California. I didn't live in California," he said years later. I do not consider myself a bigamist. Earl Woods had little interest in having a child with Cultida. After being an absentee father throughout much of his military career and then walking out on their mother, he had finally started to reconnect with his kids. After retiring from the military at age 42, Earl took a job procuring parts for defense contractor McDonnell Douglas in Long Beach, California. Under the terms of his divorce from his ex-wife, the children had the option of moving in with him after graduating from high school, and both of his sons did so. A newborn didn't really fit into Earl's plans. In most instances, Cultida honored Earl's wishes, dutifully cooking for him, cutting his hair, doing his laundry, and keeping the house. She had been raised in a patriarchal society where 95% of the population was Buddhist, and women were considered inferior to men. A common expression in Thailand was that the husband was the front legs of the elephant while the wife was the hind legs, driving and supporting the choices made by the head of the family. At the same time, childbirth and child rearing were very important elements of Thai culture. Cultida eventually made Earl understand this. "I would have been happy to be childless," Earl said. "However, in Thai culture, it's perceived that a marriage is not really a marriage until they have a child." After being married for approximately 6 years, Cultida, at age 31, got pregnant in the spring of 1975. The newness of the relationship had worn off by then, and Earl had found a new love, golf. When an army buddy introduced him to the game, he was instantly hooked. If golf were a drug, he would have qualified as an addict. He liked it so much that it consumed him, leading him to spend far more time with his clubs than with his wife. "I realized what I'd been missing my whole life," Earl said. "I decided if I had another son, I'd introduce him to golf early on." Chapter 3: A Star is Born. At 10:50 p.m. on December 30th, 1975, Cultida Woods gave birth to a baby boy at Long Beach Memorial Hospital. Shortly after the delivery, doctors informed her that she would be unable to have more children, cementing her newborn as an only child. It was clear from the outset that everything about him would be overly complicated, starting with his name, Eldrick Taunt Woods. Dreamed up exclusively for their son, the name symbolized the nature of his relationship with his parents. The E in Eldrick stood for Earl, the K for Cultida. From the moment he entered the world, Eldrick was figuratively and literally surrounded by his parents, an attention-grabbing father on one end and an authentic tiger mom on the other. Being a mother meant more to Cultida than anything. As a child, she'd been neglected by her parents, left to fend for herself. She was determined to be the mother she had always wanted. That meant she would never rely on child care or work outside the home, no matter how stressed the family finances became. She would personally teach her son to read and write and multiply and divide. For her, it was simple. She was dedicating her life to her only child. Her boy would know he was loved. But Earl had no intention of calling his son Eldrick. He immediately nicknamed him Tiger in tribute to a comrade from Vietnam. Vuong Dang Phong was a lieutenant colonel in the South Vietnamese Army whom Earl often credited with saving his life on two occasions. Once by commanding him to freeze to avoid a deadly strike from a poisonous viper, and another time by pushing him into a ditch in the midst of sniper fire. Even before that second incident, Earl had given Phong the nickname Tiger for his ferocious approach to combat. During Cultida's pregnancy, Saigon fell and the Vietnam War ended. In the aftermath, Earl lost track of his friend and feared he'd been captured and interned in a North Vietnamese camp, so, to honor him, Earl gave Phong's nickname to his baby boy. The question of race was even more complex. Through his mother's side, Tiger was one-quarter Thai and one-quarter Chinese. Through his father's side, his genes were a mix of Native American, African American, and white. His predominant heritage was clearly Asian. But Earl had every intention of raising his boy as an African-American. "The boy only has about 2 drops of black blood in him," Earl Woods said in 1993. "But like I told him, in this country, there are only 2 colors, white and non-white, and he ain't white." Erlen Kotita brought Tiger home to a 1,474-square-foot ranch house at 6704 Teakwood Street in Cypress, a city in 1975 of just over 30,000 residents that bordered on Long Beach and Anaheim. Their Orange County community had long been the site of rich rural farmland known for its strawberry fields and dairy pastures. But by the 70s, Orange County had become Richard Nixon country, overwhelmingly white and deeply conservative. As best as can be determined, the Woodses were the only interracial couple in the neighborhood. Claiming they were victims of racial intolerance, they did not interact with their neighbors. 6 months after Tiger was born, Earl's daughter, Royce, graduated from high school in San Jose and moved in with them. It's unclear how Kotita felt about having Earl's children from his first marriage come and go, but Royce ended up being a big support for her stepmother. She helped keep the house and stepped in to care for Tiger when Kotita needed rest. Before Tiger learned to talk, he started calling his stepsister Lala. She adored him so much that she adopted Lala as her nickname. Earl made himself scarce. He had a 9-to-5 job and spent much of his free time working on his golf game. When he was home, he retreated to the garage where he'd rigged up a net that enabled him to practice his swing at home. He put a square of carpet on the floor and hit balls from it into the net. The garage was his man cave, where he could smoke, sip a cold one, and refine his stroke. Best of all, it was a place of refuge. When Tiger was about 6 months old, Earl started bringing him to the garage and strapping him into a high chair, while using a 5-iron to hit ball after ball after ball after ball. Earl would talk to Tiger. Kotita sometimes would sit beside the high chair with a spoon in one hand and baby food in the other. The way she tells it, every time Earl hit the ball, Tiger would open his mouth and she would insert the spoon. She would repeat this routine until he finished his meal. It became a nightly ritual. Earl swinging and talking, Tiger watching and listening, Kotita feeding her baby. Neuroscientists have long studied the effects of repetition on a child's brain, especially during the first 3 years. The types of repetitious experience, as well as the quality of relationships in those first few years, have a powerful and lasting influence on the brain's development. For example, though television exposure levels may be high during infancy, studies have demonstrated that infants mimic far fewer actions from television than from a live demonstration. In Tiger's case, he was exposed to an extreme level of live demonstration. Based on Earl's later accounts, a conservative estimate suggests that by the time Tiger turned one, he had spent between 100 and 200 hours watching his father hit golf balls. Although Tiger doesn't remember this chapter of his life, Earl provided a detailed account of what happened one day when Tiger was about 11 months old. After watching his father practice, Tiger slid down from his high chair and picked up a club that Earl had cut down to size for him to make a toy. Then he waddled to the carpet patch, stood over a golf ball, and swung. The ball landed in the net, and Earl shouted to his wife, "Honey, get out here! We have a genius on our hands!" The notion of an 11-month-old possessing the coordination to execute a successful golf swing sounds like an embellished narrative from a bragging parent. Perhaps. After all, most children are barely able to take their first steps at 9 months, and it's not uncommon for them to be at least a year old before being able to walk without toppling over. But it would be a mistake to underestimate the effect of the inordinate amount of exposure Tiger Woods had to his father's swing. At a time when Tiger was most impressionable, Earl spent an extraordinary amount of time modeling a golf swing for him. Furthermore, neuroscientists and pediatricians agree that during the first year of life, trust develops. As one expert put it, the more love and responsiveness a caregiver extends, the more the child bonds to the caregiver. The sawed-off club that Earl created for Tiger became much more than a toy. It was a symbolic link between father and son. Instead of carrying around a security blanket or a stuffed animal, Tiger dragged a putter from one end of the house to the other. It seldom left his hand. At the same time, Tiger's mother rarely left his side, feeding him, wiping his mouth, talking to him, making him smile. Earl would later say that his relationship with Kotita began to suffer at about the same time they discovered that their little boy had an affinity for golf. Tita and I made a personal commitment to each other that we would devote all of our energies and finances to assure that he had the best we could give him, Earl wrote. Total commitment. Well, something had to give, and it was our relationship. The priority became Tiger and not each other, and in retrospect, I see that our relationship began to decline from that day on. That's a terrible